In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow. There's a very common sense reason gold is pushing to all-time highs right now. Actually, there are several reasons. The cost of goods continues to rise despite interest rate controls by the Fed. Since Jan 21, the cost of living is up 17.9%. The national debt continues to skyrocket, now above $34 trillion, causing many to worry when the house of cards will come crashing down. A presidential election year that'll have massive implications on the future of this country. All of this adds up to instability and uncertainty, and that's why so many Americans are turning to Birch Gold Group. Have you diversified your savings yet? Secure a portion of them with gold from Birch Gold. Text STRANGE to 989898 and get your free info kit. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and it doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and tens of thousands of happy customers, you can count on Birch Gold, too. Just text STRANGE to 989898 to claim your free info kit and to protect your savings from uncertainty today.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
And welcome to another episode of Strange Planet. Thanks for sticking me in your ear. On this episode, we're going to talk about the intersection between art and the unknown. Pat Benincasa, award-winning artist, is here to discuss the consciousness of art. Where does art come from? She'll attempt to answer the questions, do artists make their work alone? And where does inspiration really come from? Pat is an artist, art educator, podcaster, who loves to give form to a good idea. She'll use paint, steel, and even words to tell a good story. Her art has received national and international recognition. She's been awarded National Percent for Art and General Services Administration Art and Architecture Commissions. She hosts Fill to Capacity, a podcast for people too stubborn to quit and too creative not to make a difference. Pat Benincasa, welcome to Strange Planet. How are you?
Well, thank you, Richard. I'm just delighted to be here, and thank you for the opening. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. This is a wonderful subject for me. I, like so many people, a big Paul McCartney fan, and he has talked over the years in interviews, he sort of talked about this, how he is not the songwriter. He's more of an antenna, and then he retransmit. I remember one conversation in particular. He was talking about the song Band on the Run and how that came to be. It was a huge hit for him in 1974. It was the name of the album. And he said, the song, when it came to writing itself, he used those words, the song, when it came to writing in himself, which is, I mean, and that's what we're talking about. Where does art come from? I mean, is it, I don't know, out there in another dimension, and we're just the receivers and we transmit? I mean, you're an artist. Where do you think it comes from?
Now, if we had about 6 hours, Richard, we could really dig in deep. But I think any artist, when you make art long enough, you begin to wonder about this process, this mystery. And it is a mystery. And so when McCartney says how the idea writes itself, the song writes itself, that seems to me like, yeah. And I can only speak for myself as a visual artist. I'm not speaking for other artists, but I can tell you an example of that in my own work. I'll start a painting. I have an idea. I'm not the kind of artist that can stand in front of a painting and let it rip. I have to research and really develop ideas. So by the time I hit usually sheet metal, because I like painting on sheet. I use all sorts of crazy materials, but by the time I start the painting, I have an idea, okay? And I start hammering on this painting, and I'm working on it like day after day for weeks, 10-hour days. Painting's not letting me in. And so I keep hammering, and one day or one moment, I make a mark, I slide the paint, I sand, I'm always sanding my paintings, and something goes off, and the painting gives me a glimmer of what it wants to be. And here's the deal. Do I follow or not? And so it's a battle, because when you start a creative project, the idea, you carry it, okay? This idea comes to you, but this work has a life of its own. And when the painting lets me in like that, I yield. I will follow you wherever you take me. Let's go. So it's the painting revealing itself. That's one aspect. And I do believe that there's this huge cosmos of ideas floating around. I do believe this.
Like the Akashic Record? Or
like what?
Some call it the Akashic Record.
You could call it that. I don't know. I just have always kind of thought of it as an idea cosmos, you know, that. But it's all about that interconnection. I do believe it's like the Latin phrase, the animus mundi, that which is connected by all and to all. I love that, because it redefines creativity for me in that it's what we're receptive to. Those ideas are floating there. And I think those ideas are looking for receptive beings, for receptive people. And so sometimes I'll get a hit in an idea and think, holy Jesus, where did that come from? I don't even work that way. What is the, you know, as a younger artist, I would question. Now I don't. I just let it download me. I absorb it as much as I can.
I don't want to get too woo-woo here, unless you want to get woo-woo. But I mean,
I'm not trying to.
No. What I'm saying is my next question is kind of might be woo-woo.
Okay.
And that is because it almost sounds like you're describing an intelligence behind this, a presence. Do you feel like when you're in the throes of creativity that there is someone, something, or someone else in the room?
No, I don't feel it that way. Okay. I for myself, I do not make art by myself. I know that. It's my ancestors who guide me. It's my ancestors. You know, I'm a first generation Italian. All of my family comes from Italy. Now, Italy is so small. I have this theory that if you go back far enough, we crisscross enough, we're all cousins, okay? But that's quite a heritage to go back into. And I really believe that I'm not by myself. I feel that my ancestors channel through me. Now, are they guiding my hands? Hell no. Are they giving me just like a free pass and I just move at their direction? No, I've usually, you know, 8-10 hours a day in the studio. The equation is you work and you refine your craft and you put your heart and soul into it. And then they come, they are a part of that process. It is a process. So is there an intelligence out there? I don't know. God, any way you stuff that bird, it's still a turkey, you know? So is it an intelligence? Or let's flip it. Let's flip that notion of what you're asking, saying, what is creativity? Is it the ability to listen? I believe that creativity is in all of us, not just artists or music. It's in all of us. It's that crazy ass hunch you get when you're working on something that doesn't make a lick of sense, but it opens up a universe of possibility. Well, what is that? That's creativity.
Right, right. I've talked to a lot of inventors. I love artists and I love inventors. And they always, and I think Tesla even talked about this, how first you invented in the dream world and then you invented, you know, in the garage or the basement, wherever you happen to be physically. Do you ever dream your artwork first, a painting or?
No, I don't do it that way. But when I hit a brick wall, which is often in my work, I'm hammering away, I'll go to bed on it and I'll say, okay, you guys, you got to help me. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And I go to bed on it and I think about the problem and God, the next day I know what to do. But I trust that here's the bargain I think that creative people make. If the universe gives you the idea, you work hard to develop it, but they sure as hell are going to help you. It's a two-way street. I really believe that.
Right, right.
We don't make art in isolation, is what I'm trying to say.
Now, that makes sense. Does that speak to kind of a collective unconscious that we are tapping into?
Well, Jung certainly thought that, and there's so many theories about that. Let's flip it. I hope you don't mind me taking your questions around. Okay. Because when you ask this question, all of a sudden I'm getting all these, I'm ADD. I can have 5 thoughts at one time and I'm just chasing like shiny new. Okay. I'll come back. Okay. So, in Western culture, we think of time as linear, logical.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think creativity is multidimensional, multi-timed. It's a whole different time sequence. And it's interesting that you said, like, do you dream? Well, we in the West have that linear time frame. But my question is, what is reverie? What is recollection? What is a daydream? What is a dream? Those are all different ways that we go in and out of time. So when you think about that, and I think about it within, you know, artists, musicians, people in whatever walk of life they're in, we're all inventors, we're tinkerers. We have an idea and we start tinkering with it and examining it and trying to make it work. And to do that requires, I think the most important ingredient is play. And again, in Western time, you know, we spend time. You know, we everything's like doled out, weights and measures of what we do, except play. Play is not measured. You know, play is play. And that's when the mind can just embrace ideas and be anything it wants to be.
Fascinating, fascinating. I was admiring some of your art, and people can see for themselves your work at www.patbenincasa-art.com. And I love the your industrial cities. What do you call that? Industrial
paintings on sheet metal.
Yeah. That look like you sort of, I think you refer to these as forgotten history.
They're demolished. Excuse me. They're demolished work sites. Okay. And so the whole idea of this was, I kept thinking about place as memory. that with all of us, these sites are in our collective consciousness. And growing up, you know, you're driving on a freeway, you can look, you can see like a broken down factory. Everybody has an aunt or uncle or knew somebody that worked in a factory. At some time, at least I'm of that age where that was very real. Right. And so those paintings for me are pulling up that which should be remembered. I just think they're magnificent work sites.
They are. There's a haunting quality to them. There's a loneliness, a desolation. But at the same time, as you say, it does instill a sense of place, and people need a sense of place. I think that's maybe what's missing in society, because we're all over the place and, you know, we're scattered. It's like non-locality. I mean, everyone talks about, you know, quantum this and quantum that and non-locality, but we need locality. We need location. We need, you know, we're talking over Zoom here and so forth, but a sense of place is so important, and that really comes through your art. The other thing I really like, I love maps.
Oh, me too.
I remember as a kid, before GPS and all of that, we would take a big family trip, and we would pack into our all seven of us into a 1966 Ford Meteor, and my dad and uncle had made a tent trailer, and we would drive north of Superior, and we would hit every provincial park in Ontario, and the maps we had back then, they were called Brewer's Retail maps, the local beer store. You would pick them up at the beer store. And my mother was navigator, and she would unfurl this map across the dashboard, and she would trace out the route all the way up to past Thunder Bay and so forth. What is it about maps that it's such a part of your work? What is it about maps for you?
Maps, I fell in love with them. It started with my work with sacred geometry. I was building glass labyrinths out of cut pieces of glass. And when you look at labyrinths and sacred geometry, it's the triangle, square, and circle. And those shapes are older than time. And as I began to study them, I started to look at Roman cities and ancient cities, and they had a geometry to them. And it blew me away, and I thought, oh my God. And I realized it was time to get out of the labyrinth and into the cities. And I start breaking down these ancient cities with this beautiful geometry, sometimes in circles, sometimes as spokes.
Yes.
And as I looked at them and studied them, maps, one of the things I realized, maps will only tell you what the map maker wants you to know. Okay. Mm-hmm. If it's a dominant culture and a country invades another country, they sure as hell are going to rewrite places of importance in that country. Okay. Capitalism, you know, when you look at maps today, you know, the sites that you will see, sometimes they'll put they'll put parks, but they'll put industrial sites. But as those have kind of faded out, maps are now showing us something else. So the map maker tells us what to look at, much the way history's written. When you think dominant culture tells the story. And that's why you have history and not her story. It's history.
Right, right. Do you think one of your ancestors perhaps a cartographer?
Oh, hell, they could have been anything. They could have been.
How else do you listen to your ancestors in terms of allowing that to inform your art? How do you listen to ancestors?
Wow, that's a really a good question. I'm not psychic. I wish I were, but I'm not one of those people that can hear them like a radio. But sometimes I'll get a hunch on something and I know it's not mine. Okay. And let me back up. I'm going to tell you how I start my day. Let's go woo woo just for a moment. Okay.
Absolutely.
So I do yoga in the morning, and I despise exercise of any kind, but I do yoga. Okay, I'll just say that, and I'm going to fess up right away. So I do a yoga routine in the morning, and on that part of Shavasana, I watch a DVD, and she says, now rest your bones and your body onto the ground. And one day when I was doing that, I said, I rest my muscle and bones onto the ground. And then I realized, I said to my ancestors, I rest myself, crowd surf me into the day. Take me and crowd surf me in. And every morning I do that. Who's going to come forward today? I need help with this. I actually say, like, if whatever I'm working on, I ask, who's going to, I have this picture that maybe there's like a couple hundred of them. And they go, oh God, she has a problem with this. So-and-so, come on, come on, come on forward. She's going to need your help. So-and-so, you. No, no, you don't have to. This is that kind of problem. You know, I think they're there to help and they want to help. I just feel it. I feel when something is not my idea. And instead of saying, whoa, where the hell did that come from? I just say, whoa, thank you. Thank you. And when I'm scared, I do that. When I get, you know, if I'm dealing with something that is really difficult and painful, I say, I can't do this alone. You guys, please help me. This is bigger than I am. And isn't that art making? Isn't that creative impulse to do something bigger than us?
Right, right.
It's that impulse to connect and tell story.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't have to just be a painting or a sculpture or something in three dimensions. We strive to make our lives works of art, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I was joking with somebody one day. I said, yeah, I'm an artist and my life is my canvas. And then I thought to myself, I always had this conversation, like, whoa, where the hell did that come from? What did you just say? And so I hear myself doing that, but it comes from when I went to art schools in you know, studying art in college and graduate school, there was this work ethic that said, everything you are and do is measured by what you produce in the studio. Everything else is irrelevant. I mean, it was drilled. You know, you have to be in the studio, you have to make art, and that's your worth. And it took me many years to let go of that. And so when that came out of my mouth, I realized, okay, message received. Thank you. That creative, we're all creative, but when we compartmentalize it, like I can only be creative, let's say in my work life, or I can only be creative here or there. God, what a way to box yourself in. But if we're creative beings, which we are, we're creative all the time. All the time.
100%. Pat, we'll take a quick time out, come back, and continue to talk about the intersection between art and the unknown.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
It's time to redefine reality. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
We're back with Pat Benincasa, artist, art educator, podcaster. Tell us about the podcast. How do we listen?
Well, I do that podcast, as you mentioned, Filled to Capacity, and it's available on Apple, Spotify, all the platforms. And I'm always on the lookout for good stories. I just want to hear what people are doing, what they're putting into the world. And God knows, this world really needs it. I think one of my early ones was of a woman that survived a plane crash, woke up in the ER, and heard a voice in her head say, "This is not the end of your old life. This is the beginning of a new rich life." Now, Richard, how the hell can I not talk to somebody like that?
Exactly. Exactly.
You know? And so I've interviewed writers. I've talked to people about near-death experience. So I'm just looking for stories of what people go through. How do they get from point A to point B when life throws everything at them? I've talked to people who've gone through incredible medical trials with their joy intact. I want to know how they do that. I want to be that. I want to be like that.
You were talking earlier about sometimes your ancestors leave you clues.
Mm-hmm.
Like breadcrumbs, right? Hansel and Gretel.
Yeah.
Breadcrumbs. Can you give me an example? Anything come to mind where you were maybe stuck, you were working on a piece, you were stuck, and they left you some breadcrumbs?
So I was talking about that creative process, that when you're really lost and you're trying to figure out what to do, two things can happen. One, you can either shut down and feel shame and embarrassed or think, God, why can't I get this? And then you kind of implode on yourself, which I don't like doing. You know, I did enough of that as a younger artist. I like plan B, where you realize that what you're thinking or doing, it's not fitting. It's not working. And so immediately it's like the antenna go out. And just an awareness. And so one example was I got a commission to do a skylight for the Minnesota Judicial Center on the state capitol grounds. It was a Percent for Arts competition. And I had just been working in glass for a year. I was a painter. And I started experimenting in glass, and I went after this competition thinking, oh, that'll accelerate my learning curve. Yeah. Well, long story short, I won. And so now I had to come up with these ideas. And I realized that if I was going to do something to win this competition, I couldn't do a flat skylight. Okay. I don't like flat windows, and I sure as hell don't like flat skylights. I have a thing about it. You know, windows like the earth were once thought to be flat. Okay, just leave that out there. So I designed a three-dimensional skylight. And as I was working, I built a 6-foot by 7-foot birch replica of the site to which, where it was going to go. Okay, because I found out that on the committee, the architect already had somebody he wanted to do the project, someone who was really good at judicial center skylights, but his were always flat. And I was going through a divorce. My life couldn't have been worse. And I thought, if I'm going to go for this, I'm going to go for broke. So I cleaned out my savings, built this birch plywood. So one day in the studio, I had all this glass lying around, like leaning against the wall, art glass, like tinted color glass textured. And I saw two pieces overlapping. And it knocked the wind right out of me. I thought, oh my God. I will do glass overlays, so when the sun travels east to west, it'll be the light from the sun that will mix those colors. That's all I have to do. All I have to do is put those three-dimensional glass forms in place, and then the atmosphere will do everything. Now, how the hell would I get an idea like that? I'm sorry, okay? And the whole piece is almost pure geometry. And I went to Catholic school and I got D- in geometry because the nun felt sorry for me. Okay. So, you know, these ideas of these geometric constructs, where did they come from? What, I mean, how did I even know to do that? And sometimes I look at this piece, I go back to that building thing, Jesus, who did that? You know, is this real? So something like that. Now, had I been frustrated, I might not even look at those glass overlays, the way they were casting reflection on each other. That's what I'm talking about.
Amazing. Yes, there is a picture of that on your website, benincasa-art.com. It is beautiful. That must be a heck of a thing to clean, though.
Well, I designed it in such a way that it's open, and there's a catwalk on top, by the way. And so when we built it, I had to laminate each 614 pieces of glass had to be laminated. Okay. And 3M is here. It's down the street from us. And I called them and said, would you like to laminate a three-dimensional skylight? And they go, huh? And long story short, they gave us the laminate so I had to build a 6-foot oven, hot plate. We had to warm up the glass, wash the glass, put the laminate on, squeegee it on both sides. 614 pieces. But, you know, it worked out because if someone dropped a tool above, it's like a car windshield. You don't want shards of glass coming down.
Right, right.
Is that too much shop talk, Richard?
Not at all. And God willing, that skylight will be there for 150 years, maybe longer, maybe, you know. How does that make you feel? I mean, that's immortality in a way.
You know, as an artist, you put your work out there. Okay. And I'm really moved when my work has an effect on somebody. That to me is the price of admission right there. If this piece is to last, I would be really, really happy. I'd be thrilled. You know, everything is so impermanent. I did a three-dimensional chapel window that actually punches out in real space. The window is 34 glass pieces, art glass, and it goes out away from the building. Again, I don't like flat windows. And the notion of this for a chapel is called Redemption Window, and it's a 10-foot glass cross on limestone boulders. And that whole project came about because I had been working on two-sided windows for months, all through the 90s. I thought, why would a window have to look the same on the outside as it is on the inside? Now, why? I mean, really, and architects will do beautiful things with facade, stone, metal, but nobody ever touches the window. It makes me crazy. So this window actually goes out because I don't like the idea that you have to go to a place to find the sacred. You have to go to sacred places to find sacred. I think bullshit. The sacred is in us. We carry that in us. So the whole point of the window is that it goes out in real space, and at night when it lights up, it's like looking at an aquarium. The light spills out of the building. And then the president of the school where this chapel is, he called me after it was done. He said, we got a problem. I said, what? What could be the problem? He said, people want to get married in front of it. People are wanting to come in, to have ceremony. And I thought, my God, it doesn't get any better than that. Nothing can top that.
We'll take a quick time out. Pat Benincasa, the intersection of art and the unknown. Stay with us.
The truth will set you free. Free. But first, it will really tick you off. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Artist, art educator, Pat Benincasa is here. Pat Benincasa-art.com. Check out her podcast as well. Fill to Capacity, wherever you find your podcasts. What makes art timeless?
I think that's a great question. I think that when you look at a work of art, and let me answer it a different way. You're going to a museum and all of a sudden you see a painting that was done maybe 300 years ago, and you stop dead in your tracks And it's like somebody just clutched your heart and you so identify with it. And it doesn't matter that it was done 300 or 200 or 50 years ago. It speaks to the very core of you. That is timeless. A work of art that can cross nations, borders, gender, you name it. When it crosses all those constructs, all those social constructs, and speaks soul to soul, heart to heart, I think for me, that is the definition of timeless.
For me, it's Starry Night, Vincent van Gogh. I've got one hanging, a print, obviously, just around the corner from the studio. Which one is it for you that speaks to you so powerfully?
Oh, that's like asking a mother, talk about your favorite child, okay? So, okay. I would have to say the first time that happened to me, I was 12 years old, and I rode my bike to Hudson's department store in Detroit, and on the top floor they had a bookstore, and I opened a book called Western Painting. Now, no one in my family ever talked about art. I went to Catholic school. They didn't talk about art, but I went right to this book. I opened it, and I saw Giotto's painting of St. Francis. Now, Giotto is around 13th century, and up until then, you have these icons, these Madonna icons in gold, and they're just stunningly beautiful. And all of a sudden, this guy makes a painting of St. Francis. When I saw that, the tenderness in the expression on the face, the colors, the palette, it was like it was so familiar to me, so intimate. I felt like I was looking at a book of family history. And I gasped. I mean, as a 12-year-old, I didn't know what the hell I was looking at. All I knew, short of having a seraphim opening up the sky and spilling out and hearing the hallelujah chorus, it just riveted me. And I thought, I was so perplexed. What is this? What is this? What? And the beauty and the tenderness. And to this day, I have images of Giotto's paintings all over the house because I still look at it and I think, you son of a bitch, how did you do that? How did you know to put that there? How did you know to make expressions so tender? How did you know to use contemporary clothing of the time? That was radical. It was taking a frozen notion of what painting is, and he made it intimate. He made it communal. He made it a marvelous story. You know, like, I don't know if you've ever had older relatives say, hey, let me tell you about the time this happened with your uncle so in, and you go, oh, yeah, tell me. It was a story. And that was my first time. Just, it was breathtaking.
Have you, I know you said, how did you do that? Have you reflected on that? I mean, do you have any answers as to not just Giotto and that particular painting, but with Van Gogh and Starry Night or whatever? If someone hears it could be a piece of music. It could be, a concerto by Bach. But what are they, I guess we've been talking about this really, but what they're tapping into to be able to create something like that reaches out through time to people and has such an incredible impact.
I often wonder, I don't have answers for you. I just have tons of questions. As I get older, I ask more questions. But one word keeps coming back to me, surrender. In the creative process, you can either force a piece like, this is what I want to make, this is what I'm going to do, and this is how it's going to look. It's never about that. You jumpstart the idea. But if you surrender to the painting, you allow it to guide you, or the piece of music to guide you. I think surrender is connected to timelessness because it taps, you were asking earlier about the collective unconscious. Is that a piece of it? Is that a piece of what makes something so beautiful? Or when you're driving and you look in your rearview mirror and you see this gorgeous sunset, sometimes I've wanted to burst into tears. It is so moving. How many sunsets have we seen in our lifetime? But you turn your head and you look, And it's like as if the sky painted something so new and so old. There's a quality of time bending, I think, in Timeless. It is so old and new simultaneously. It's pure contradiction. And that's what I love about art. It's so freaking contradictive.
Fascinating. Just getting back to the podcast for a minute. How do you, I understand you have kind of a unique way of preparing for an interview.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So there's an occupational hazard to being an artist. And that is you got to make art about everything. Okay. That's just the way it rolls. So when people were saying you ought to do a podcast, I thought, what the hell do I know about a podcast? I'm an artist. You know, I know my studio. And so I thought, okay. Also, I love to teach and I stopped teaching full time and I miss that. So it was like a perfect storm. So I started podcasting, and as I was researching people, I realized I spend weeks researching somebody. I read their books, whatever it is about them. I get photos, and I realized I started making a graphic, a poster about their life. So what happened was once I make that poster about somebody's life, I know what to ask them. I know what to do. So if you go to my website and you click fill to capacity, you'll see an image of everybody that I have interviewed. And what you'll find is you'll see a graphic announcing them, who I've you know, interviewed. But if you click on it at the very end, you'll see a poster devoted to their life and their life work. So I have to make art about these people. Then I know what to do with them. But if I don't do that, and I just rely on, you know, how much can you trust words here, really, Richard? For me, it's the image, it's the visual, it's the painted word, you know?
Right, right. Well, language is so inadequate, really, as a technology, when you think about it.
Yeah. So I do a graphic image of someone's life and their work, and then I know them. I know them.
That's amazing. I'm just looking one here. Dr. Scott Taylor.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Talking about shared death experiences.
Yep, yep. And with Scott, his graphic on top is different. If you go down to the poster, you're going to see curling.
Yes.
Okay. The guy's a curling junkie. He loves curling. And so when I found that out about him, how am I not going to put that into his poster? I know he does the near death. He's an expert on near death experiences, but there's something so wonderfully vulnerable and human about the guy. And I love that he loves curling. And he curled at, he's from Minnesota. And not far from me is the Selby Street Curling Club where he worked. Now, come on, these gifts of serendipity. Now, how can I not put that on there? So it's the way that the images give me nonverbal information. It's a way of knowing. And I guess we ask ourselves, when you talk about creativity, how willing am I to suspend linear knowing? How willing am I to embrace the mystery? And that's scary for me. I want to control everything. You know, artists are very controlling. We make little universes in our artwork. You can't find more control freaks. That's what we do. But the beauty and the power is in the mystery. It's in contradiction. It's the things that don't add up that just open multiverses of possibility. I want to be like Emily Dickinson. I want to dwell in possibility.
Do you ever get lost in a painting?
Oh, hell yes. I get so lost. And what that means for me is that, again, as a younger artist, I'd say, oh, what's wrong with me? Why can't I figure this out? You know, it's all ego when you're young. You want to, you know, make these paintings. But as I've grown, okay, let me just back up for a minute. People think that if you're talented, you just go to the studio and produce. And when I was teaching art, I'd tell kids, hell no, you got to grow into your talent. You grow into the talent. So when you are lost, when I'm lost, I've learned now, step away. Step away from it. Go do something. Go read. Sometimes emotionally, I'm not at a place where the painting is showing me. You know, when they talk about a writer's block or creative block, you know, kids with students would freak out about that. And I'd say, instead of thinking of it as a block, maybe think of it, you're being downloaded with so much information that your emotional self has not caught up to it. Chill. Give yourself time to absorb it. It's okay. Your talented self can handle it. Think about it that way. So when I hit blocks like that, and they've kicked my ass from here to the next zip code, I tell you what, I leave humbled from the studio. Sometimes I'll stop and just start cleaning the studio, or I'll curse. I like cursing a lot, but that's why artists have studios. You can do whatever you want in that studio, and you do it in private. You never grow up in public, you know?
We've been talking about the intersection of art and the unknown. There's also the intersection of art and commerce. And I'm going to make another sort of reference to the Beatles here, because I love the Beatles, and they were such wonderful tunesmiths, but they also had to produce, right? They were under such pressure. And I remember a conversation, again, it was McCartney and John Lennon talking about how they were under such pressure. They had to write an entire, or compose an entire album, like 12, 15 tracks. It's a short period of time, and they would write a song, and sometimes they came so easily, and they would say, well, that's a swimming pool, you know, when they were first starting out and they were enjoying the fame and the money, you know, they'd write a song, well, that's a swimming pool, and we just wrote another one, you know, that's a brand new car. I mean, I enjoy the music, but it almost taints hearing them say that kind of taints the what am I trying to say here? It doesn't sit well with me to hear that song was a swimming pool to you, but to me, you know, or someone else, that may have changed their life.
But why are they opposed to each other, Richard? Why do they have to be the notion? So for example, in art school, you're taught you got to starve for your art and don't sell out. Well, these were professors making top dollar, having health insurance, telling young people like me, I think, yeah. And then all of a sudden, as I think, wait a minute. Okay, so this notion that somehow art has to be pure and outside of commerce. I hate the commodification of art in the art world. I despise it, okay? There are parts of that that I just, you know, it's big business. Collectors collect, they donate to museums. Do museums start collecting that artist, and it's you know, it's the way of the world. Okay, that goes on. Let's go back to what you're saying. So for them, it was the swimming pool or the car, but they grew up in poverty. They were working class. True. So I don't think that art has to be separate from childhood trauma or the way you grew up. Even if you were wealthy and you had this aspiration, you put your work out there and all the lives it touches, oh my God. So for them at that time, they were measuring success. You know, that was the 60s. Everything was about success, you know, the good life, advertise, everything, you know, being on top of your game. And so it was like the zeitgeist. And it's always there, but these kids, and they were kids at the time,
sure,
they were kicking out music that to this day, just, whoa, talk about connecting soul to soul.
Right, right.
But I don't care if they got 50 swimming pools, I don't care. But look at how hard they worked at their craft. Look at what they did and how hard they worked at it.
Right. No, I certainly don't begrudge them the money. I mean, I love free enterprise and I love commerce. But I guess it's like they were dismissing their own work as a, you know, this is a swimming pool to them. But
yep.
To me, it meant so much. And to other people, it meant so much. Maybe, you know, I don't begrudge them the money. Maybe I just prefer I hadn't heard that conversation.
Let me ask you this. I'll tell you, as an artist, if someone said to me, my God, this painting is magnificent, it moves my soul.
You're right.
Or the redemption window that people want to get married, and I still get emails about it. Okay. If I went into every piece saying, I've got to make a piece now that will move souls, geez, I'd freeze up. And maybe that gave them a room to play. If they pretended like, well, it's the swimming pool. It took that pressure off, as opposed to someone saying, okay, you guys, you got to write another seminal hit that will live, be timeless, that other artists will record. Well, I don't know about you, but that would really intimidate me.
Excellent point. There, you talked me off the ledge, Pat. Thank you.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Also, Richard, you're hitting a key point about people who make art and music. You have to know yourself. So, for example, as a young artist, I was told, if you don't live in New York and you're not in a museum by 40, you're a washout and your work doesn't matter. Now, if I bought it, and you should be male too, but at that time you're supposed to be male, but hey, the cards I was given, that ain't going to work. So, coming back, the whole idea of knowing yourself, I went to New York several times to see shows, but I knew in my heart of hearts, I couldn't live in New York and make art. I'm not made that way. I'm wound up tighter than a thoroughbred. I'd be a nervous wreck. That kind of competition. And I made peace with myself. Okay, you can't do that. Find a place. I went after graduate school, I moved to Minneapolis. It was a wonderful place. Midwest was wide open, museums, cheap studios. Okay, you have to know what you are and what how you can keep your feet on the ground. The other thing I knew, I did not want to make work that I had to live off of. And I ended up teaching, and I love teaching art. I loved it. What I did in the studio, I did in the classroom. And so I took that pressure off my art. I was always able to follow the idea. I didn't give a rip. Am I going to sell it or not? I always followed the idea. And bless those people who can live off their paintings or their music. I think that is really gutsy. I can't do that. I'm not made that way.
Excellent points. Wow. I learned a lot, Pat. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
It's great hanging out with you. Pat Benincasa. And again, the website, patbenincasa-art.com. The link is in the episode notes. And don't forget the podcast, Fill to Capacity, available wherever podcasts are available. Pat, thanks again.
Richard, it's an honor to be on your show. Thank you so much. Great conversation. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Subscribe at StrangePlanetPodcast.com.